I'm JC, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm not a professional speaker. This is the first time I've ever done this. So I hope I do a good job, touch somebody's heart. I want to congratulate everybody that got a token today and all the newcomers. Exactly 17 years and 7 months ago was the last time that I had any chemicals in my system. And that particular day was a Saturday, and in April 18th, 1992, and there was a big AA convention, spring convention down in San Diego, and I had a girlfriend who was going to AA and trying to get sober, and I was going to AA to keep everybody away from her, and she was trying to get away from me, and she got tickets to the convention, and so they had a speaker that night, they had a dance that night, and they had a dinner that night, and there was probably about 2,000 or 3,000 people that showed up, and I showed up, and I wasn't in very good shape, and I don't remember a word that was said that night. I don't remember exactly how I got there. I don't remember how I got home. I remember being pissed off and everybody else looking really happy. And what I do know is about 2 a.m., I somehow got back to my place, a little apartment that I had in Escondido, California, and I took all my stuff and flushed it down the commode. And I'd done that before, but and later usually regretted that. And I got up that morning on April 19th, 1992, went to a 7 o'clock meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, 7 a.m. meeting, and something was really different. I knew it was different. And I went there by myself. I didn't want what I had. I knew AA worked. I'd been in AA before. I'd gotten 5.5 years sobriety at one time, and had been in and out for about 2 years. And I hit bottom. And I did not want what I had. And every time that I'd come to AA before, every time that I'd quit throughout my drinking and drugging career, there's always been a lot of bounce in me. I'd get sober a few days later. It didn't seem that bad. I wasn't that bad, you know, I got over that, you know. But I could tell there was no bounce. And I came in, and I had tears in my eyes, and I asked these men at this men's meeting to help me, that I needed help. And these guys, I've been pissing them off for about 2 years. Because I've been coming into meetings and in various stages of non-chemically free way, and shared a lot, and they didn't like that, of course, and I didn't listen to anybody, and that's the guy that they knew, and that day they knew somebody else was there, and these guys, they came up and they put their arms around me and they said, I don't ever have to drink or use again, and they knew that something happened to me, and some of them did, and but everybody was friendly and everybody kept telling me to come back, and that's that day I didn't believe in myself anymore. You know, I had reached that point that our book talks about as a pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. You know, I didn't like my old ideas. I didn't believe in myself. I had hit a new bottom that I didn't understand, and I was scared. I felt like a total loser and a wreck of a person, and I was at the point where I wanted to kill myself because I was so despondent over everything. But that was the beginning of sobriety for me. And my story goes back. I was raised in and out of East Texas. And I come from my mother, my real father, my grandparents. None of them were alcoholic, though I did have I did have a brother and a sister that were alcoholic. And I had one sister that wasn't. My father was a World War II he was in the Air Force during World War II. He was a navigator on a bomber. And then he met my mom at the tail end of World War II. And military dances. I can't remember the name of them, but anyway, he met her there. They married. She was very young. She'd quit school real young, and they had a couple of kids, my sister and me. My father was killed in the Korean War, and when I was about 6 months old, my mom remarried. The guy she remarried was an alcoholic. So that was really the first alcoholism that she dealt with. And he was a pretty typical alcoholic, I guess, in a lot of ways for a guy. You know, when he was drunk, he didn't know what to expect. When he wasn't drunk, he was irritable. I know now he was restless, irritable, and discontent. And I was very scared of that guy. When he was drinking, I was scared of him because he was brutal, two-fisted, drunk. When he wasn't drinking, I was scared of him because he was irritated. He was irritable. So I stayed away from him and didn't want to be like him. And when I was a pretty good kid. I was kind of like a Huckleberry Finn type of kid. I grew up out in the country. I ran around barefooted and liked to fish and trap animals and catch things and swim in the creeks and bayous and ponds of East Texas, and that's where I grew up, and I really liked that. We moved to Houston, Texas, into the urban world, and I joined the Boy Scouts, and I liked that a lot because we went camping a lot and hiking, and I really enjoyed that kind of stuff, you know. And then a couple things happened between me and the old man, and I got a real big chip on my shoulder, and around 14, I just turned bad. You know, I just really, I hated everything. And I started running around with all the thugs in our area. And we lived in a kind of real rough area of Houston, Texas, a lot of rough areas down there. And I started getting in all kinds of trouble. And my first drunk, I didn't learn how to drink around a kitchen table at dinner. A bunch of us guys that were drinking, or a bunch of the older guys, they got a bunch of the younger guys, asked us if we wanted to get drunk, and we got somebody to buy us some booze, and we from a little grocery store, and there's a big junkyard next to it, and we jumped the fence with the beer and got drunk in these old rusty cars. And that first night, that was the first time I'd ever been drunk. I had some taste of beer before, so I knew what it tasted like, but I never knew what being drunk was like, and I liked drunk right away. And I got drunk that night, and got arrested that night. Got beat up by the cops that night for resisting arrest, and got taken home, and the old man took the belt to me, and the cops told him that I had been in a gang fight, which I hadn't been. You know, they'd roughed me up, and I tried to tell him the truth, and he was telling me that I was a little liar. And anyway, my mom, she put me on restriction. And the next morning, I woke up hungover, feeling like crap, and I called up a buddy of mine and told him, I can't wait to do that again. And that's the way my drinking career started. I loved drunk. I didn't like sober. And for the next 7 years, that's what I did. I stayed drunk all the time as much as I possibly could. I got into all the other stuff, you know, like every chemical that was available at that time, I took. If there's something I didn't take, it's because it wasn't available when I was around. I took everything I could find, and I took it as much as I could. And but alcohol was always one of my favorites. Beer wasn't. And I had a... I loved being drunk, but because growing up in the home that I grew up in, I had a real kind of love-hate relationship with alcohol, because seeing my old man, stepfather, drunk a lot, and the way he was when he was drunk, I kind of looked at alcohol as bad also, you know, because I was always wanting to see him not get drunk and not hit my mother or anything. So, you know, I had I never saw alcohol as a... I heard somebody say the other day they saw alcohol as a part of their success because they, you know, they grew up in a family where alcohol was part of the business relationship and all that. I never saw it like that. You know, I saw alcohol as kind of it was good to get drunk with, but then it had a lot of bad consequences. So I kind of thought of it like that. I didn't think of drugs like that though. I liked those, and I didn't see the bad side of that. But I went on like that, and I got, because I went to the bike, outlaw biker route, and got into that stuff, and got into a lot of trouble, and was into motorcycles, and running around, and so I put myself right into the thick of the fire, and I was burned a lot, you know, in terms of, I was in jail a lot, getting arrested all the time on the weekends, during the week, and for different things, and getting in a lot of trouble. All of it was, you know, I was always high and drunk, and by the time I was 21, I was at a club one night, and I was pulling away from the biker crowd, and one of the prospects, we got in a fight, and I ended up getting stabbed in the heart, and was almost died from that, and in the hospital I met a good friend of mine, who later became a good friend of mine, and he was also shot that night, and I decided I wanted something different. You know, I didn't want that life anymore. And I'd already had a bunch of that kind of stuff happening over the last 6 years. And so now it's about 21. And I decided, you know, I didn't like being drunk all the time. And I was going to get some control over that. And I started trying to pull away from that crowd and didn't know how to do it. And I tried to drink normally, and I couldn't do it. Every time I drank, I got drunk. And I was determined to drink normal. I knew people who could just go out and have a couple drinks. I would go to work with somebody. We would go to the bar afterwards and say, let's just go grab a couple. I'd have a couple, and I was ready to go, and they'd say, I got to go. I got to go home to the wife or whatever. And it's like, what are you talking about? You know, we're just getting warmed up. And I could never stop. You know, and I'd see other people do that, and I was trying to, and I couldn't do it. And I went through a couple of years bouncing in and out, and I thought, well, you know, I'm going to go join the Navy. I wanted to go join the Marines, and my family taught me out of it, because our family had a tradition of, the Norwegian side of my family had a tradition of a maritime tradition, so they were always going out to sea. A lot of merchant marines and Coast Guard people in my family, and they talked me out of it. I went to the Navy, and I thought that was going to help me out with my drinking, and it really didn't, you know. They got a strong drinking culture there, but I was doing the same thing there, trying to control and enjoy my drinking, and every time I drank, I got drunk. Every time. And very still, I could probably count the amount of times I drank and didn't get drunk on one hand. You know, but I was always thinking like that. And so I had gotten to the point where I was drinking sometimes and then trying not to drink, you know. And not drinking was hard, because I'd say I wasn't going to drink and I would end up getting drunk. And I couldn't understand these two things, you know. One is I decided I was not going to drink, and I didn't end up getting drunk. I didn't end up taking a drink. I always found a reason to take the first drink. I always had a reason to take the first drink. And then I started getting drunk. I couldn't find reasons to explain why I got so drunk after I took the first drink. You know, I could justify the first drink, but I couldn't justify all the drinks afterwards. Not all the time. So, you know, I wanted to get drunk some of the time. I didn't want to get drunk all the time. I wanted to go out and have a couple of drinks sometimes. Sometimes I wanted to have maybe six or eight, or thinking like that, you know, just get a nice, good buzz going. Sometimes I wanted to get, you know, plastered. But what happened was I always ended up plastered. And I didn't like that, you know, and I started feeling like there was something really wrong with me, you know, and I started feeling crazy too, because I didn't know where I was going to wake up. I had no control. I didn't trust myself about, no matter, you know, when I got up in the morning, I didn't know what was going to happen. I went through a few marriages during this time, you know, all bad marriages. They were all made, you know, in the middle of drinking and everything, all the other stuff, and there was no commitment there. I had no belief in a power greater than myself. So there was zero commitment to the marriage. And I remember my first marriage. I got drunk before the before the wedding with some friends, and I remember standing at the altar thinking, you know, if this thing doesn't work out, I'll just get a divorce. I remember thinking that right when they were going to ask me the I do question. You know, that was my attitude. And the second marriage I got into in the Navy, and she was just a drinking buddy, and somehow she got pregnant, and I never got any other drinking buddies of mine pregnant, you know, but that didn't really work out too good. And I had two kids from that marriage, and the two little girls, they meant a lot to me. Though the wife really didn't mean that much to me. I wanted the kids, but it was a bad marriage, and she understood that, and she went back to where she was from, and then I met my wife number three, And that was one I thought was going to work out, but we were just two different, I think, culturally. She came from Russia. But we had another, and I had another child with her, but in that 1984, she was getting sick of my drinking. I had a little business, meat and seafood business, and delivered a lot of stuff out to East Texas, and I arranged that business around traveling away from Houston. And when I traveled, I could do what I wanted to do, because around the house I basically abstained. And so that was a way to release. And I would go out and drink at least 2 or 3 days a week, and get rip-roaring drunk on my business trips. And but you know, I couldn't always control that it was only going to be when I was at work. And I started, and it was upsetting her quite a bit, the way I drank. And in the meantime, I had started going to college. I was a high school dropout, and I'd got my GED in the Navy, and I started going to college. And it was really a struggle to go to college, because I'd show up in class plastered, you know, and I'd be embarrassed, or I couldn't remember to do my work, or, you know, I'd be drunk and didn't do it. And so I was always, you know, messing up, and I dropped out of several classes, and I'd gotten a couple classes done, you know, and it was a real struggle. But anyway, during all that time, she got pretty fed up. One night I showed up, October 16th, 1984, I showed up about 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, when I was supposed to have been home about 5 o'clock that night, and I was real messed up, and my in-laws were there, and everybody's freaking out, and they ran out to my truck, and they found some other stuff out there, and I was all plastered, and she said she was going to leave me if I didn't go to AA, and I said, okay, I'll go to AA, and I went to the bed and went to sleep right away, and woke up, and I suspected, you know, you know, tell her I'm sorry, and, you know, she'd forgive me, and everything would go back to normal. And I went to work that day, and I came home at, and that morning she said something about the AA, and I said, oh yeah, yeah, we'll do that. And I came back home, that night, and she said she had, the AA meeting was all set up. And I was like, what are you talking about? Like, that was 12 hours ago, you know, I'm better now, you know. I don't need that thing, you know. But, she said, oh no, there's a meeting over at so-and-so, and, it starts at 8 o'clock, and there's a guy that's going to meet you there, and you know, you're supposed to go there, you promised. And I said, okay. So I went there at 8 o'clock, and I come walking through the door, and there's a meeting with about this many people, and there was a table right by the front door, and I come walking through the door, and some guy goes, hey, I go by Chris and JC. Back then I was mostly Chris, but this guy goes, hey, are you Chris? And how did he know that? Yeah. Now you can recognize a newcomer usually. But I said, yeah. And he came over, and he said, I'm so-and-so, and I don't remember his name. And he handed me a big book for free, and it was $6 then. And I took the big book. I still have that book today. But and they sat me down and told me all about AA. Everybody was excited about telling me about AA. And it was, you know, I was just couldn't wait to get out of there, you know. And I went into the meeting. The meeting started, and it was kind of trippy. You know, here was people that had been dealing with a lot of stuff I'd been dealing with for all these years on my own, and they would handle it, you know. And I kind of saw AA as like some kind of bastardized form of group therapy. You know, that's what it looked like to me. I mean, I didn't understand what it was, and I wasn't listening to anything, but I hung around, and they said 90 meetings in 90 days, and I went to 89 meetings, and I skipped that 90th meeting, and I came back on 91 days just to tell them I didn't go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I didn't want to do that, you know. And they were all telling me how simple it was, and I was thinking, you know, I'm a very complicated person. You know, this stuff is real simple, and you guys, it probably works for you guys, but I got really serious issues here, and I just hung around. I had managed to get 5.5 years sobriety, got into college, and back to college, and went all the way through, and did about 7 years of college, and meantime, we moved out here to California, and we had that, my third child, Katarina, who I'm very close to, and when she was about 3 years sober, I was finishing up graduate school at National University down in San Diego, and, you know, one day I was riding my motorcycle up the hill to Ramona, and I got a piece of metal in my eye, and I couldn't get it out. And I hadn't been going to meetings since I moved to California, essentially. And my ex-wife asked her to drive me down there. She wouldn't drive me down there. She's kind of fed up with me. And going to school and working all the time, and I was back to restless, irritable, discontent, selfish, self-centered, self-seeking, childish, immature, grandiose, you know, all those things. Liar, cheat, and a thief. I was all those things again. And sober. And going to school. And I ended up going down to the hospital myself. Drove down there with one eye down this mountain trail. It was real dangerous, considered the most dangerous 11-mile stretch in California. I'm driving it at night, one eye. And got down there, had a big resentment. The doctor pulls a little metal out and says, I'm going to prescribe you something. And I'm thinking about telling him, no, I'm an alcoholic drug addict. You know, I can't take anything in it. But I didn't say anything. And he hands me the prescription. And I'm thinking, well, I'll just throw it away. But I walk by the pharmacy and I hand it to the pharmacist. And I'm thinking, well, I just won't pick it up. And I sat there. And then he calls my name. And I went and got the bottle. I said, well, I'll just hold on to it. And I walked by a water fountain and swallowed about four or five. You know, it's been 5.5 years. And I was dry swallowing them all the way back up the mountain. Next day, I called up the pharmacist and said, hey, I lost my pill bottle. You know, and, oh, okay, no problem. Got another one. I relapsed. I didn't tell anybody about that relapse for several months. Finished up college. And I went to a couple of AA meetings in the meantime. Man, I never felt so bad in an AA meeting in my life. Sitting in that meeting, I felt like everybody knew I was a liar. You know, everybody knew that, I never felt so phony in my life. And I felt pretty phony before, but that was about as phony as I ever felt, sitting in a meeting with Alcoholics Anonymous, knowing that I had relapsed and telling everybody I had 5.5 years. And about the time that I finished up school, my wife and I separated. She found somebody else that she worked with, and I was angry about that. And I went full blown back into my disease, and I started drinking, and it was worse than ever in a very short order. And I got to where I was drinking. Had a lot of fun during that time too, but I was drinking around the clock. I never drank quite like that before. I mean, I would wake up in the middle of the night from sleep. If I was sleeping in the middle of the night, I'd wake up, I had to drink. Had to drink first thing in the morning. Had to drink all day. I was running a boys' home down south, a 44-bed boys' ranch. And I had worked my way up to administrator, and I was drinking all day during that job. I was taking meds out of the state and swallowing those pain pills and stuff. You know, I was just doing everything, and maintaining, and as best I could. I couldn't quit drinking all day long, every day, all night. Whenever I answered the phone, I drank mixed drinks at night quite often. Anytime anybody called me, people were calling me all the time, and you could hear the tinkling in the glass. I remember it was so loud in my ears, I was always thinking, you know, everybody can hear that, you know, and I was just drunk all the time, stoned all the time, doing everything. Lost that job, got another job, lost that job, started getting DUIs, and my second DUI, got me back to how they send you to AA. So I remember my second DUI, we're sitting in DUI class, the instructor is telling us all about blood alcohol level and how much it takes for a person this weight to reach this level of drunkenness. And they asked everybody what their blood alcohol level was. I had like the lowest blood alcohol level in the class. I was like 0.08. Everybody else was like a 0.20 or 0.15 or whatever. You know, they had pretty high levels. Mine was real low. And they were asking everybody how much they drank. And everybody was saying, oh, just two or just three or one or all this. And they asked me how many I drank. I had drank at least 40 that day. You know, I'd been drinking all day. I don't know why my blood alcohol level didn't show that high. I was drunk. But, you know, I guess at the time they caught me, you know, it wasn't that bad. But and I just said I probably had about 40 drinks. Because I was sitting there listening to everybody. I knew everybody was lying. I knew everybody in that DUI class was lying. They couldn't possibly have had that blood alcohol level and only had one or two drinks. And I knew I'd had 40 drinks, and what my alcohol level was half what theirs was. I knew they were all lying. And it made me miss AA in a way. You know, something I knew, you know, I can't lie to myself. And I started going back to AA. And I went in and out. I couldn't really, and then I quit drinking. And I didn't drink the last year I was out there. You know, I finally got to AA and I quit drinking, but I couldn't do the AA program. I had too many of my own ideas. You know, I was a half major guy, you know. I was smarter than everybody around here, you know, and I wasn't going to listen. I wasn't going to take any directions. You know, I was going to do it my way. And I was on my, I had my marijuana program. You know, I had my my pain pill program, and I used those instead of steps, and they didn't work very good. And then I had a few other things I threw in there here and there, and I was drinking a lot of that near beer stuff. Drank a lot of that because I wanted to drink. I wanted to drink real bad, and I was miserable. And it just got to that point where on that last meeting I went to, that speaker's meeting, you know, I like to think that something was said at that meeting, April 18th. April 18th, 1992. Because I don't know what happened. I don't know why a guy like me, who thought he could figure out his way out of any mess, could suddenly get to that point where he was willing to let go of all his old ideas. I reached that point that day. Our book says some of us tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. And it was nil. The results were nil until I let go absolutely. And for some reason, I was able to let go that day. And I became like a blank slate. And I didn't believe in myself anymore. And I was starting, that's how the, you know, I found out that was the best way to be. April 19th, 1992 seemed like the worst day of my life that morning. I look back today, and it's like the best day of my life. It was the day I was reborn. You know, when I was born, I was a blank slate. I didn't know anything. I didn't have any ideas. And that's the point I had to reach to try to do this program. And you had to let go of all this twisted thinking. My whole personality and all my, you know, all my development from 14 on was developed with a sick mind soaking in a toxic cocktail of drugs and alcohol. Every experience, every thought, every action, every behavior, everything I did was tainted by alcohol and drugs soaking in my brain. And that's how I learned. So I let go that day. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know I was letting go. I didn't know what was happening. But I did let go. And I remember I got a sponsor. I'd gotten sponsors before, and I got sponsors that I thought were weak that I could control. And I wanted to show them how sharp I was. And I don't think I impressed any of them, but I impressed myself. But I got a sponsor that I was scared to death of. He had about 30 years. He's an old bosun's mate and a great, great guy. And he hated me. he hated me. He'd been around me for 2 years and longer, and I was disgusting to him. But he was a guy with 30 years and a man's man, but he was the first guy that greeted anybody that walked through the door of Alcoholics Anonymous. He got them pamphlets. He didn't care if they looked like they just crawled out of a dumpster or if they looked like they just left medical school. You know, he was the first guy. He shook everybody's hands. He made sure the coffee was done. He did all kinds of stuff, you know, and he was a real man. And he wasn't afraid to show his emotions. He wasn't afraid to show his soft side. He was the most helpful guy I'd ever seen, and I asked him to sponsor me because I knew he saw through me, you know, and I wanted somebody that saw through me. And he saw through me, and he told me he wouldn't sponsor me. And then he said, well, he told me he'd think about it. And I came back and asked him the next day, will you sponsor me? He goes, I don't know, I'll think about it. And I did that for a while, you know. And pretty soon he just started telling me what to do. And I would come up to him for the most simple things. You know, I didn't trust any of my thinking anymore. And I would ask him simple things. Things that I wouldn't even think about today, you know. But I'd ask him and say, oh, just do this and just do that. You always have the answer. And it was right. And it was different from that. It was different from the solution I was going to do myself, usually, you know. My thinking was twisted. I didn't realize that. I couldn't accept that. But having a sponsor with sobriety that was firmly founded in this program was one of the best things that I ever did for myself. You know, and he guided me along and guided me through the steps, showed me how to do the amends. He let me work slowly with the God thing. I was a rabid agnostic atheist when I got here. I'd been raised that way. My stepfather had made sure that I was an agnostic atheist, and by his own beliefs, and he didn't want any of that stuff talked about in the house, and I believed like that, like him, and so that was a very that was one of those things that's hard to deal with. But you know, in AA they told me you just gotta be willing to be willing to be willing, you know. And they said it's about coming to believe. You don't have to believe anything. You know, you can come here and just have the tiny little faith of a mustard seed, you know. The tiniest little bit of faith, you know, just be, you know, the tiniest bit of willingness, you know. You don't have to believe anything here. You know, you can just believe. They come and just believe in the power of the room here. The people in this room are more powerful than you are. You know, together we can move a big rock. You can't move that big rock. And so I just started, I turned it over to the, you know, my higher power became AA. And that was fine. That was a great beginning. That's all you need for a beginning. And that's what I found. And I started doing the steps that way. And I went to a step study meeting every Friday. We read from the 12 and 12. I went there for several years. For the first year, I would only talk when it was about the first step. I didn't want to talk about anything else. They'd call on me. I go, no, I'm on the first step. And by the end of that year, I'd done most of my amends. I'd done most of the steps. I'd turned my will. I decided. I looked at that third step almost every day. I'd look at it on the wall and think about it. You know, turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood it. What the heck does that mean? You know, what does that mean? You know, I didn't know what that meant, but I knew I was going to do it. I didn't want to do it as a hypocrite. I wanted to do it real, and eventually I was able to do that. I came to believe, just like they said. My life turned around. Everything started getting better. My thinking started getting better. My little daughter that was 3 years old at the time, she can't ever remember me being drunk. She's now 22 years old, never seen me drunk. She thinks of me as Mr. Sobriety in her mind, you know. She lives up in New York City going to school. I got a relationship with my oldest daughter. I don't really have a relationship with my middle daughter. She's one of us and doesn't know it. She's got some stuff to face. But anyway, AA has been very good to me. It's been the best thing that ever happened to me. I was reborn in this program in a way that I never would have believed could have happened. I've got a faith and a power greater than myself today that enables me to walk through anything that life puts out in front of me. And you new guys, what I can say is... people that have been around, all of us, we know where you're at. You know, we've all been there. Everybody that's got some time in this program had one day. You know, everybody had 2 weeks. Everybody had 30 days, 60 days, 90 days. You know, we know what it's like. And some days, early on, I hated AA. Other days, I loved AA. Some days, one minute I liked it, one minute I didn't, you know. I was all over the place, you know, bouncing all over, had all kinds of issues and problems, you know. But I kept using the program as a solution to my problems, and it kept working, and I kept finding myself better, you know. And I kept waking up knowing where I was going to wake up the next day, and I didn't have a lot of remorse when I woke up, and it just kept getting better. And that's what happens, you know. All the old-timers around here, they've walked through all kinds of stuff. Everything you're walking through, we've walked through. And a lot of other stuff. I've learned how to walk through everything sober without taking a drink. I haven't even wanted a drink for 17 and a half years. I haven't even wanted any of the other funny stuff. Nothing. And I haven't even wanted it. And I've faced all kinds of stuff. You know, we face that stuff, you know. And walked through it with some dignity and self-respect. That never had before. I used alcohol and drugs to face everything. If I went to the movie, I wanted to smoke a joint. You know, if I went to a party, I wanted to drink before the party. You know, I drank after the party. You know, I drank during the party. You know, everything that I did, you know, if I wanted to drive, I wanted to be high. Everything I did was around alcohol and drugs my whole life, and faced all problems. Today, I face everything sober, and I don't have to do it alone. There's people in this program. I keep going back to the program. And the power greater than myself that gives me the strength to walk through this, everything that happens, you know, day by day. And, you know, I only have to not drink today, you know, and it's always today. It's always right now. It's never not today. And that's what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. So, you know, it's just like, I don't drink right now. I can drink tomorrow, and when I get there, it's not tomorrow anymore, it's today, so I can't drink that day, you know. So I stay sober one day at a time. I don't pick up that first drink no matter what. There's nothing that a drink can help me with today. You know, there's nothing so good in life that I couldn't ruin it by taking a drink or a drug, because I'm an alcoholic. Nothing is so good that I couldn't ruin it. I could win the lottery today, and get drunk with $250 million in the bank, and I could ruin it real quickly. Hit somebody, be in jail, get sued, and I can just picture all the things that could happen. There's nothing so bad that I couldn't make it worse by taking a drink, because I'm an alcoholic. You know, my family considers me a rock. I don't consider myself a rock, but they do. They do. I was the black sheep of my family. And today they call me for all kinds of things. I've done the eulogy for my brother's funeral, who's one of us who died out there. You know, and he was the good guy when I was growing up, you know. And I was the bad guy. And I did the eulogy at his funeral. But there's nothing so bad I couldn't ruin it by taking a drink. There's nothing to drink over anymore, you know. If I drank today over something bad, I would make it so much worse, you know. And, you know, I have an opportunity to make things a lot better, you know. I really appreciate the opportunity to come up here and share tonight. Thank you.